investing in real estate is probably less risky than investing in Bitcoin. Maybe. I say that while chuckling a little bit.
90% of my portfolio is tied up in crypto right now. I'm going big on it. Hi, and welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook. We're coming to you from Seattle, where we report each day on what's happening around us in technology, science, and innovation. What happens here matters everywhere, and every week on this show, we talk about some of the biggest and most interesting stories we've been covering. This week, we're talking about deals, deals, and more deals. Yes, the market for acquisitions, IPOs, venture capital financings, and SPACs is on fire. In fact, IPO dollar volume and merger and acquisitions are already at record levels. To learn more about what's driving this activity, we're joined by Ben Gilbert, co-founder of Seattle venture capital firm Pioneer Square Labs and co-host of the awesome Acquired podcast. Make sure you tune in and listen to that as well. Ben, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me, John. Great to be here.
Absolutely. So as I said, the market is on fire right now with acquisitions, IPOs, deals. You're on the front lines of this, seeing a lot of deals, I'm sure, coming across your desk. What is going on right now? I mean, I've covered the venture capital scene for 20 plus years, and even the dot-com boom of the late 90s, this seems really, really frothy to me in terms of the valuations and the amount of activity we're seeing. So help put this in a little bit of perspective for us.
Yeah, well, John, if you're open to it, I know this is going to be a little boring and academic versus starting and say, deals are crazy right now. But I think let's pop up a level and just look at a little bit of the macroeconomic climate, because I think it's always helpful to see how the public markets inform the private markets, since we ultimately are all in the business here in investing in and creating companies at the startup stage that hopefully go on to be big public companies at some point or big pieces of them. And I think anyone out there who's been investing in public companies over the last couple of years is sort of scratching their heads at the moment going, my gosh, asset prices, stock prices, even real estate, all investment assets are really high right now. And when I say high, I mean relative to their sort of underlying intrinsic potential value. So think about the amount of revenue something could generate in a year or profit something could generate in a year. And you look at the multiples, the number of future years of that revenue or profit or cash flow that are being factored into what the current valuations of these companies are. You know, even let's just look at stocks to keep it kind of simple, since that's something everybody sort of checks on a reasonable basis. They're really high. And this is both a byproduct of the fact that, you know, in the last year, especially in the technology sector, there were certain companies where their market opportunity happened 10 years before everybody thought it was, because everyone got pulled online. You see these Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, Google, like the reason that some of these companies are so valuable right now is because the whole world was forced to sort of adopt technology much faster than anyone had sort of forecasted. But on top of that, you of course have to look at monetary policy and see that with interest rates being at an all-time low and stimulus being pumped into the economy, we also have that playing a huge role where, you know, it's hard to generate a return on things relative to what you could say 10 years ago. And therefore, there's sort of more money piling into what appear to be the most attractive assets driving prices up. So I want to level set with that from a super macroeconomic perspective. And then I think we can sort of let that inform, okay, well, now that we have that picture in mind of what's going on in the whole economy, let's look at startups.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess take one part of that with the monetary policy and interest rates. You know, I'm a dummy. So tell me, why does that impact the valuations and IPOs and M&A? How, you know, tie that together for us.
Yeah, great point. And I will say this is something that, you know, my background is as an engineer, as a product manager, started Pioneer Square Labs to start companies, now investing at PSL Ventures out of our venture fund. And this has been a learning journey for me over the last decade, because I used to hear people talk about interest rates as it applies to like tech startups. And I was like, why, how are those things related at all? So I appreciate you sort of calling that out, because this has been a journey for me. So the way that I like to think about it is, if I have a single dollar and I'm looking to invest that somewhere, I'm looking for the best risk-adjusted return possible. So some things are going to be riskier than others. You know, if investing in real estate is probably less risky than investing in Bitcoin, maybe. I say that while chuckling a little bit.
90% of my portfolio is tied up in crypto right now. I'm going big on it.
All right. We could shift this podcast a very different direction in a hurry then.
Yes, that's right. So
if I'm looking for the best sort of risk-adjusted return, then either I could look at investing in something very boring, like bonds, where I can get a guaranteed return on that over a period of time, or I could look at, you know, the whole other variety of options of things I could invest in. And if bonds are giving me a really, really low yield right now, a very low percentage, or any sort of debt investment, when they say low interest rates, that's typically sort of the first thing you go look at. Then you're like, okay, well, that's unattractive to invest in that, because that's only going to give me 1% interest. Yikes. Where can I go get better than that on a risk-adjusted basis? And so everyone that used to invest in, you know, that used to look to that is now saying, geez, how about tech stocks? And of course, that's very oversimplifying, but you sort of can look at the supply-demand equation and see that with low interest rates means that it's more attractive to invest in things like equities, stocks.
And do you think that's a permanent change?
I think it's cyclical. In fact, I was just the other day, someone sent me this really great explainer on YouTube that folks should watch if they're curious about this. It's called How the Economic Machine Works by Ray Dalio. And it explains the short-term debt cycle, the long-term debt cycle. I mean, as a nation and as a world, we're getting more productive as the years go on. GDPs are going up. General wealth and wellness is going up. But amidst that, it's not a straight sort of nice, easy rise over all the years without ups or downs. We have this very cyclical nature of the interplay between interest rates and asset prices and inflation. And so I think we're in a period right now where there's very intentional moves being made by the Fed to keep interest rates low, to keep the economy flowing, especially coming out of the pandemic where, you know, there was a big risk of the whole economy sort of seizing up. And no, I don't think it's permanent. I think even this morning, the Fed had signaled something like 2023, we want to start raising rates again. And so, those things change, and 2023 is a long way away. But at some point here, there has to be sort of a reversion to the mean a little bit.
So, Ben, let's talk about this as it relates to your job at Pioneer Square Labs. What are you seeing out there? And can you kind of put this in your own terms of like how your job has been impacted based on what we're seeing as the increased deal activity just in the last, you know, several months, and maybe compare that to when, you know, 3-5 years ago, what you were seeing?
Yeah, for sure. Well, on a variety of different perspectives, it is one of the best times, if not the best time in the world, to be doing a startup. And this, of course, comes because there's an incredibly mature tech ecosystem to build your startup on top of in terms of all the tooling that's available. You can build on AWS, you know, everything's sort of plug and play. Talent, of course, is very expensive, but it's easier to get started than it's ever been. But from the financial perspective, you know, the trickle down of people seeking, or capital investors seeking better returns, is that they look at things like venture capital, and you know, they as an asset class, as a place that they should be investing, because we are seeing that startups and technology in particular do produce some of the best. You know, that's where the innovation is. That's where a lot of the drive of our economy comes from. And so I think that for people who are looking to start a startup, of course, we talked about the tooling, but on the financing side, there's more money than ever available to you as a founder, because people have found investing in venture capital as an asset class, or you know, anything that touches tech companies, to be a great place to invest. And so the way that that ends up showing up in our work as PSL, the studio, and PSL Ventures, the venture fund, is, of course, more, whenever you have a supply-demand equation, more supply, in this case, supply of money, will affect the price of things. And so valuations go up because it's more competitive to fund companies than ever. And I think when I say it's a great time to be a founder, you know, I think that the amount of time it takes to raise money is shorter. The amount of your company that you have to sell is way less than if you think back to the sort of 2000 era where you were selling a huge chunk of your company to just scrape together, you know, a few $100,000. Those days are gone. And I think that I think this is actually good for everyone long-term because it just enables a lot more innovation in our ecosystem.
We're talking to Ben Gilbert, co-founder of Pioneer Square Labs, about all of the deal activity going on here in 2021. Ben, I want to drill down a little bit more on this being the best time to do a startup and go a little bit deeper on that. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back here in just a moment.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT certs included.
Welcome back to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook. I'm joined today by Ben Gilbert. He is the co-founder of Pioneer Square Labs, a Seattle area venture capital firm, and also the co-host of the Acquired podcast. Ben, we were just talking before the break about how this is the best time to start a startup. I was meeting with an entrepreneur friend the other night for dinner, and he was telling me a story about one of his top engineers who was making, I don't know, around $150,000. And one of the big tech giants came in and offered this engineer like $250,000, you know? And so, and this is causing real strain and discomfort for entrepreneurs. So I want to push back a little bit on that because it seems like it's maybe not the easiest time to start a company because you're dealing with this, you know, these massive tech companies. And I think maybe some politicians in Washington, D.C. would say it's actually not a fair time to start a company. And so I just want to have you elaborate a little bit on that, both on the talent and maybe that's why companies are having to raise, you know, $100 million now because they have to compete with Microsoft, Amazon, Google, who are paying enormous wages to engineers. And as you we all know, you know, it's all about the talent you can hire for your company. So is that a big concern that you're seeing with startups? And is this a reason that they're raising so much money?
This absolutely is a reason they're raising so much money. It's totally a concern. I think it's harder to hire engineers than it's ever been for startups. I didn't coin this quote, but I definitely believe it, that it's the easiest time ever to start a company, and it's the hardest time ever to scale a company. Because you're right, you are competing with these crazy offers that are being made by big tech companies that are not only big from a market cap valuation perspective, they spit off a ton of cash. And so in being so profitable and so defensible, the offers that they can make to candidates, even just in a cash comp perspective, is remarkable and incredibly hard to compete against as a startup. So, you know, I think about this a few ways. One, if you're an early stage startup recruiting an engineer and that engineer says, well, I kind of want to go and be like a level 61 engineer at Microsoft. And you're like, I kind of stop competing at that point. Because I say, look, like these are incredibly different lives that you're choosing between here. And if that is attractive to you to go and do that right now, like more power to you. Maybe we should talk in a couple of years. I don't think that we're ever going to make a short-term compensation offer that even comes close to what someone could make at a big company. So they have to want to be there for a very different reason, the mission of the company, the excitement of being at a startup. And then, of course, there's the long-term payoff, which, especially if you join a company early, could be really promising. But I was thinking about this the other day, in part inspired by a great essay that Packy McCormick wrote, who's a great Substack writer. The piece is something like Dreams All the Way Up. It's kind of a funny title. And he pointed out that, you know, big companies used to be like $100 billion market cap. Now we have these $1 trillion companies, soon to be multi-$1 trillion companies. It's commonplace for companies to IPO above $10 billion. There are dozens and dozens of tech companies now that are above $10 billion in market cap. Private startups are several billion dollars. Like, there's hundreds of unicorns. And so there's a strong argument to be made that, you know, these markets are that technology is addressing now. It's not just tech markets, it's every market. And so these companies can really be more valuable and address bigger markets and be more profitable than anyone ever thought. And so, geez, maybe your equity could be worth 5 times as much, 10 times as much at sort of terminal value than it could have been, than anyone thought we could have been worth maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah, you know, I guess 100 billion is not cool anymore. It's going to be 1 trillion is cool. So, it's pretty crazy. I think the other thing that I've been wondering about, it kind of ties back in our discussion here of big tech and these companies now with $1 trillion market values. I mean, there has been a lot of government scrutiny of big tech, yet you still see big deals happening. I mean, with some of these companies, which is a bit surprising to me. I thought they would tap the brakes on their acquisitions, but you've got, you know, Salesforce buying Slack, you've got Amazon going into the movie business with MGM, and it's just like kind of crazy. And Microsoft buying Nuance, you know, a big company. You know, that's a Nuance is not a small player in speech communications. Why is that happening? And does that surprise you that they're just plowing ahead with these? I know they have a lot of cash, as you said earlier, but at some point, it seems like the government scrutiny would maybe, you know, have them tap the brakes a bit more, but it doesn't seem to be the case. What are your thoughts on that?
I think all the new pieces of legislation are proof that they're getting serious about not only breaking up big tech, but about figuring out how to potentially redefine monopoly power or redefine anti-competitive behavior. To date, I think tech companies have been playing a little bit of a game of chicken where they're thinking, unless I do something really flagrant, like Facebook trying to go buy another Instagram, you know, making an offer for TikTok or something like that, I'll probably be fine. They probably won't undo something I did. And of course, it does have to go through the normal 6 to 9 months, different approval processes. The thing that is the most surprising to me is that Microsoft is coming out of this scot-free. And
oh, yes.
I mean, John, yeah. You were here during the DOJ era. How remarkable is that?
They have played this so well. I mean, they absolutely are flying under the radar and are trying to come off as the, you know, the champion of consumers and privacy. And like, you know, Brad Smith, the president of Microsoft, I think has learned some lessons and they've got scar tissue from that era. And they are, I totally agree with you. I think Microsoft is swimming under the radar of most of the challenges. Now, of course, for the most part, they don't run a marketplace business like an Amazon or Facebook or Google. And, you know, so they, it's a different type of model, not as much built around advertising. But yeah, I totally agree with you. It's really interesting to see. And I think they're positioned really well right now to continue the momentum. So yeah, that's going to be interesting. And I think the other news that just occurred with Lina Khan getting confirmed to the FTC, this is the legal scholar who is extremely sharp and also a big time critic of big tech.
In particular, Amazon.
So it's going to be interesting to see what happens with that appointment getting confirmed here just recently. So something to watch. And I think, as you said, you know, this will potentially have an impact on mergers and acquisitions coming up. You know, I wanted to circle back on valuations because you're looking at valuations every day, and it seems really hard in your business to try to figure out what a company is valued at right now. You know, a great example here in the Seattle area, we covered Okta's acquisition of Auth0, and pointing this out because last year Auth0 was valued at $1.9 billion, and in less than 12 months, Okta comes in and pays $6 billion. I mean, so it seems pretty crazy that their valuation tripled in less than 12 months. I don't think they're...
It must have just been a couple of great quarters in there, John. I'm sure that's all it was.
Okay, I don't know. It seemed like a great outcome for them. But how in that climate, when you're seeing valuations really spike rapidly and somebody who wants to pay that much, I mean, how are you personally trying to figure out how to value a company?
Yeah, All right, let me take these three things in order. So the first one being sort of what, so I don't know anyone at Auth0 or Okta closely, so I don't have a lot of details on that, but in the abstract, you know, how does evaluation?
Well, you need to do an acquired change. Podcast with Eugenio Pace.
Totally.
He'd be a great guest.
Totally
for
you. Too. Yeah. And then getting into how do we think about valuation, or at least I think about valuation at PSL. Well, the first thing is just multiple expansion. And I'll to define that for a minute, if you look at the average multiple of revenue that a given software as a service company is trading at in the public markets, it used to be like 10 to 15. Now it's like 20 to 25. And that has gone up a lot in the last year.
So you're saying 20 to 25 times revenue would be the valuation now versus 10 to 15 times revenue, 3 or 5 years ago.
Yep. For the most sort of high flying software as a service companies. And that is partially driven by the macroeconomic stuff that we opened this with, where people are just saying, hey, I believe in the future of these tech companies a lot more than I believe in sort of old world industrials, or potentially just, hey, I have way too much cash. And so I'm willing to pay more to own a tech stock, because if I look around at all the other stuff I could own, this seems like it has the brightest future in front of it. So sure, I'll pay more. So that's sort of the first thing, is a lot of companies, even if they didn't meaningfully grow revenue, would just be valued higher today than a couple of years ago. And so that I think there's some element of that in a deal where something goes from 2 billion to 6 billion. The other thing that I think plays into that is when an acquirer decides that they want to buy a company, you kind of have to figure out what they're buying it for. And this is something that we have sort of classically done on acquired episodes, where we call it acquisition category. Is it, you know, the lowest thing where they're buying just the talent, kind of an acqui-hire? Is it the highest value where it's a strategic acquisition, where they're trying to realize some synergies? I apologize for using that word, but it's probably the best fit.
So like Salesforce buying Slack would probably be a good example.
Like, clearly they were doing more than just valuing Slack for a reasonable multiple of its cash flows, or of its profits, or maybe of its revenues if it wasn't profitable. And so I think when you see something like that, where there's market consolidation, oftentimes because it's really strategic, they feel that they can have pricing power, or they feel that they're able to bundle these two services into one. For whatever reason, they're willing to say, actually, this business is more valuable to us than it would be to an independent set of other investors holding this business and not having the value of combining it with ours. And so sometimes that's why you see these like eye-popping prices that people are paying. For example, when Visa attempted to buy Plaid and that fell apart, everyone's like, whoa, that valuation's crazy. But actually, it could have sort of defended Visa from a dangerous future where Plaid unseated them at some point in the future, at least in one of their business lines. And so that's one reason they're willing to pay so much for sort of a takeout type acquisition, where they're saying, gosh, you know, the worst case scenario here is like we lose all of our existing revenue. So this is worth a big percentage of our company to just go trade a bunch of our stock in order to bring this thing into the fold and neutralize that threat, which of course takes us right back to the antitrust conversation that we were having a moment ago.
Yeah, well, there's also the example of competition too. I mean, a company that wants to keep a certain product away from somebody else too, which would also potentially drive that valuation up with multiple bids. And like if you're Salesforce and you want to keep Slack out of the hands of Microsoft, you're probably willing to pay a heavy price on that. So,
and for folks who are interested in this topic, whenever a public company buys another public company, there's a ton of disclosure that gets posted on the SEC's EDGAR website, and you can go read through. And it won't name the companies, but it will say Party A, Party B, Party C, and you can figure out like, how is the price getting bid up? And what is, somebody got an email at the 11th hour. And so then they got a new bid. And, you know, a lot of this is competitive dynamics too.
Yeah. I love diving into those SEC filings. You're as much of a nerd on this stuff as I am. We are talking to Ben Gilbert. He is the co-founder of Pioneer Square Labs and the co-host of the Acquired podcast. We're going to take a short break, but when we get back, I'm going to ask Ben some of his favorite acquisitions from the Acquired podcast. So stick around. Welcome back to the GeekWire podcast. I am GeekWire co-founder John Cook. I'm joined today by Ben Gilbert. He is the co-founder of Pioneer Square Labs, a Seattle area venture capital firm, and the co-host of the Acquired podcast. Ben, I teased ahead of the Acquired podcast. Anybody who's interested in acquisitions, valuations, all the geeky stuff we're talking about here, make sure you subscribe to the Acquired podcast. I think you can just go to acquired.fm. Is that easiest way to find you?
That's right. Or anywhere where fine podcasts are distributed.
Excellent. Well, as I said, I want to hear your thoughts on, because you've interviewed dozens of people who've gone through acquisitions, had exits of some sort. And I first want to ask you if there's any commonalities you see across all of those interviews you've done with the companies and the entrepreneurs in terms of what has led to a successful acquisition, both during the transaction and then afterwards as it's integrated into the company. Anything stand out to you in terms of themes that make these deals work?
Yeah, absolutely. Two big things. One is they tend to go well if the acquirer knows why they're buying the company and is able to clearly articulate that and have buy-in at every level of their organization. I think a lot of the times these companies get bought, someone has a great idea, but there's not internal alignment. And then somehow over the ensuing years, the whole thing gets scuttled. Or perhaps someone thinks it's going to be strategic to buy them, but when they actually start integrating it, they realize, ooh, we're afraid of cannibalizing our existing business. And so they don't integrate it well.
What's an example of that? I'm curious if you can point to a couple examples of where the integration just did not go well.
A great example is here in our backyard with Microsoft acquiring Nokia. I think that is one.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Microsoft acquiring Aquantive, which is probably another example. But Nokia, probably more people know the Nokia brand, but that's a good one.
I think that's another fair, very fair criticism of that era of Microsoft was not great at acquisitions.
Yeah. And the point there was, I think Microsoft was trying to get in the game on mobile, which it had lost big time to Apple. So you could make the argument, hey, they need to have a mobile play in order to be a gigantic tech company going forward. But they seem to be doing okay without it.
Yeah, it's been impressive to watch Microsoft shift to more of a horizontal company than needing to sort of be a vertical competing platform versus Apple and Google and say, look, our web services are available to anyone on any device. We make all of our applications to go on any devices. You don't have to be hardcore and only use Windows and only buy our, Surface devices in order to use them. It is difficult to overstate what a massive cultural shift it is for that company to move away from being the Windows company. It's truly impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I kind of threw a wrench there in our discussion. I was asking kind of for common themes, and we went down the path of things that don't work out. So maybe expand a little bit on when it does work out and maybe some examples of where that's occurred.
Yeah. So we did this episode a while back, the 10 best acquisitions of all time, because we frequently get a tweet of like, what's the best acquisition of all time? And I'd sort of like got into the habit of writing the answer out. And I was like, let's just actually analytically do this and figure out how much an acquisition has contributed to the growth in the enterprise value or the market cap or the, what makes a company valuable, and look across all companies in the world ever. And an interesting thing was we didn't specifically, is my co-host David Rosenthal and I, and we didn't try to specifically look at tech companies, but it ended up being the case that they were almost all tech companies. And when they weren't tech, they were media. And in many ways, media is like the precursor to internet technology businesses, where it has this incredible business model advantage where for every additional reader or listener or consumer of the content that you bring on, it doesn't cost you an additional marginal dollar to create the content. And so if you can find a way to scale audience, the world is your freaking oyster in media business, because you can maintain a fixed cost base and just continue to stack revenue. Software is like that, but with an even one more layer on top of it, which is reusability. Where once you read an article, cool, you've read the article. You may reference it in 3 years if you forgot what was in it. But if you write a SaaS application, well, you have that cool principle we talked about where you can keep adding customers and it doesn't cost you more money really to create product for those customers or costs of goods sold. But it does have that additional property where, like, I'm going to log in and use Slack every single day, but I'm probably not going to go reread that article every single day. So that's a long preamble to say they're either technology or media businesses, these acquisitions that have gone really well. And the ones that are truly, you know, multi-dozen billion dollar of profit, if you think about, like, you buy a company and you hope that it ends up being worth more over time than what you sort of paid to acquire it. Think about Instagram, think about Marvel, think about what's another great example? Google acquiring DoubleClick. Speaking of the Aquantive issue, of course they were direct competitors. These were tech and media businesses that were bought not for cost synergies, which can be a reasonable reason to acquire something where you want to, you know, have one cost structure across two different businesses, but they were revenue creative, where they were able to realize a whole new revenue stream because they brought this thing into the fold. And so you think about, like, a Marvel, you know, they bought the IP, which is worth something on its own, but it's worth, this is Disney, of course, this is, but think about how much more it's worth when they're able to bring it into the Disney film production pipeline and crank out a movie every year, and then have that IP across all their theme parks, so realize all the theme park and merch revenue. And now, of course, with Disney Plus, I'm in the middle of watching Loki right now. It's exceptional. And they're finding just more and more and more monetization opportunities, more new revenue from that one sort of fixed asset base.
Yeah, I don't think I've listened to that episode. So, Ben, you're going to have to quiz me on what the top deals are. I think you probably referenced a few of them.
Yeah.
But let me see if I can get number one. I think Facebook, Instagram's in the top 10.
Yep, that's our number one.
And that's number one? Oh, okay.
I spoiled it. I mean, that was the one I...
You spoiled it. Yeah, well, it's so good that it's going to potentially get reversed by the government.
At this point, there's no way. You can't untangle that web.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was going to say maybe Microsoft LinkedIn is in there, but maybe it's too early to do a full analysis.
I think we don't know. It's hard to find information on that or even estimate it.
Yeah.
It's not broken out.
Yeah, interesting. But then there's also the smaller deals where it becomes a giant component of a company. Are there good examples of that? Like maybe it's a $20 or $30 million deal of a startup that becomes, I think that might have been the case with Google, that, like, what became Gmail. I'm not certain on that. Maybe you can fact check me.
Gmail was home rolled, but Writely became Google Docs. They bought Writely.
Okay. Yeah. So, and probably for not much money.
No, almost nothing. It was right after launch too. And then they bought three companies that actually became Google Maps. I think it was Zip2 or maybe Where2. Keyhole was the other one that sort of became Google Earth. So that was Google has been very good at acquiring companies that sort of fit into the Google suite of products. There is one small acquisition that made our top 10 list. And that one was and it's kind of funny saying small by today's standards.
Yeah. Give me a hint on it and I'll see if I can figure it out.
1997.
Ooh boy. Wow. Was it Amazon?
It was not Amazon.
Okay. Gosh, that's too distant for me. That's too distant for me.
I'll also tell you, it was a set of core technologies that are incredibly valuable, but the person they acquired was also very valuable.
Microsoft with Ray Ozzie.
It's in that vein. It is Apple acquiring. What do you think, John? 1997.
Would have to be something tied to the iPhone, right?
It is. It ended up creating the iPhone or the iPhone software.
I can't remember. I wasn't following Apple that closely.
Next.
Oh, okay. I just kind of consider that Next, you know, part of the larger Apple family, you know, it's just like.
And at this point, it truly is. But the craziest thing is they spent $429 million and the Next Step operating system and the Cocoa UI framework and Objective-C and the whole thing is the core software behind Mac OS, behind iPhone OS. It is like it was a bet on a completely different technology direction that ended up underpinning, you know, trillions of dollars of market cap.
Yeah. Wow. You know, you've talked about and interviewed dozens of people as it relates to acquisitions. Who's your favorite either interview or what's your favorite acquisition across all those episodes and why?
Dave and I had the pleasure of flying down to where was this one? This was in Santa Monica, and we interviewed Nolan Bushnell, who is, of course, the founder of Atari.
And Chuck E. Cheese, right? Or something like that?
And Chuck E. Cheese, yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the cooler thing.
Truly. And I couldn't believe it. It actually essentially spun out of Atari, where Nolan realized, hey, we make money once when we sell one of these Atari kits to someone at home. And, you know, it was long before software as a service or anything like that. So they made money once. He's like, but when we sell machines to like these pizza parlors that like just throw it in the corner, they make money every time someone does a coin drop. So we want that. So he opened up Chuck E. Cheese as a way to say, I'm going to sell pizza, I'm going to collect the coins, and we're going to make the games.
But why Nolan Bushnell? Why was he your favorite? And why do you think cool acquisition story?
Yeah, he's from a different era. I mean, I think that it really helped me understand. First of all, he effectively invented the video game industry, which is now close to a $200 billion industry, which is wild. Bigger than Hollywood, bigger than music. People always feel like, oh, it's a game, it's kind of a toy. But like it's I think the biggest entertainment industry in our economy now. Walking in and realizing, oh, I'm meeting this person who invented an industry that's larger than music and movies was wild. But he's just got so many crazy stories about how different things were then. It was the Wild West in tech. I mean, it was their first investment when they raised venture capital. It was the very first investment made by Sequoia Capital. And so, you know, there was no sort of precedent of how these deals get done. There was no like, of course we use the standard term sheet. I mean, it was Don Valentine showing up and signing documents that, you know, his lawyer wrote for the first time on the trunk of the car outside the Atari office. You know, it's just a very, you could make a movie about how they built that company.
So Ben, let's fast forward. What do you see coming as it relates to acquisitions? I want to get your predictions on who you think might get acquired here in the next 6 to 12 months.
That's a good one. Well, I do think we're going to continue to see very large acquisitions. I think we're going to continue to see very large, either all stock or partial stock acquisitions, because, you know, I just did a very deep dive, 10 hours of audio on Berkshire Hathaway. And it's very clear that when Berkshire is highly valued, they use the stock for acquisitions. And of course, when the company perceives its intrinsic value is above the market price, they of course use cash. And I think with as richly valued as a lot of these companies are right now, looking at their market caps going, geez, we should use our stock as currency for something. We're going to continue to see a record pace of deals getting done and a lot of stock deals getting done because of that. All right. So you asked me in particular who. I think Dropbox is sitting out there as an acquisition target for someone. I mean, if you pull up their stock chart since they IPO'd, and I can't remember what it was, maybe 2018, it's pretty much worth today what it was worth then. And that's not really true for most mid or large size tech companies, especially that are so in the public consciousness that have really built a brand around connectivity, productivity. And so I think they're just sitting there waiting for one of the big five tech companies to make a run at.
Yeah, good point. They're trading at $29.24, and 5 years ago they were at $28.48. So yeah, not much movement there. Yeah, that's interesting. What about companies like taking Amazon, where they've experimented and failed trying to get into like video games? You mentioned Bushnell and Atari. I mean, do you see certain sectors where some of these larger tech companies might have a puzzle piece that's missing for them and they could fill with acquisitions? And if so, who are some of those? What are those puzzle pieces and who are some of those players?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we're going to continue to see, if you look at e-commerce and payments, I think everyone's going to use their initial position as a wedge to try and own more of the ecosystem. So I could see Stripe doing a lot. I think they've been very smart, by the way. I think they're very, not only savvy acquirers, but savvy investors, realizing what's not on their roadmap, but leading rounds as if they're a venture firm into companies that are sort of in their ecosystem that maybe they'll acquire. Maybe they just like owning 20, 30% of for the long term. But I think Stripe will continue to sort of expand beyond payments into payment adjacent things, be it through their internal roadmap or acquisition. Similarly, I think you're going to continue to see like Shopify say, well, what could we do beyond just hosting their service and processing their payments? And, you know, what could they do with fulfillment? What could they do with, you know, content management systems, that sort of thing. So I think anyone right now where, if you're an independent small business and you're setting up the infrastructure for your business and you have to go to 2, 3, 4 companies, I think everyone's going to basically say, well, how can I be the one-stop shop to run everything for your business?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, the thing that I was thinking just about Netflix kind of expanding into these adjacent industries where they came out there starting some experimentation in gaming. We're staying on the gaming front. So maybe that's one to watch. But these big companies, their appetite and their sphere of what they play in is so vast that, you know, it's really kind of anything, as you see with like an Amazon buying a Whole Foods and then an MGM and, you know, who knows, the AMC movie theater chain or whatever. I mean, it seems like there's endless possibilities for these big companies, but they got to be careful because of the government regulation.
Yeah, the MGM, do you remember the price on the MGM deal?
Was it $9 billion?
It was something in that neighborhood. It was less than what Amazon spends on content costs for Amazon Prime Video over the course of the year, or at least what was reported. So it's interesting that everyone is sort of jumping to this like, whoa, Amazon bought a movie studio? Crazy. They're expanding into everything. When I think really they saw an opportunity with a pseudo struggling studio that had an incredible set of IP to basically say, look, we're going to spend this money anyway. We could home grow some content that sometimes it works well. You know, you get like a Man in the High Castle type thing. Sometimes it falls flat on its face. And maybe instead of doing that, let's just see if we can do a bunch of cool stuff with James Bond and do a bunch of cool stuff with Rocky. I can't remember what else is in that that catalog, but I think that one is more of a Amazon just being savvy at rolling something into their core business that they were going to do anyway, and then getting a lot of headlines around because MGM is such a historic movie brand, everyone feeling like it was a new strategy for them.
I think it was last quarter when you looked across all acquisitions, media and entertainment, I think was even surpassed technology as the number one category. Now there was the big, what's the Discovery tie up? That was like a $35 billion deal or something. Yeah. Well, I need to know every single deal that has occurred this year because there's so many of them happening.
Your point on media makes a lot of sense because I think that I remember reading the Bob Iger book, The Ride of a Lifetime, and he was making the point about why they made that big bid for Fox and potentially overpaid for it, that media today is really about scale. Like, they realized, I think Fox realized, hey, we don't have the global scale that Disney does just in terms of distribution. We have it outside of the US, but you know, we don't have the US penetration that a Disney does. And that, hey, we're going to go sell ourselves to one of the very large media companies. And it wouldn't surprise me if we continue to see even additional consolidation in media, because the way that that business model that I was describing earlier, that you know very well, John, of, you know, you'd create something and then you try and get it in front of as many people as possible, will take into its logical extreme. I mean, Netflix has is it 100 million, 100 and something million people that subscribe now. And for them, every time they go and acquire one more person, it's like sort of free because they've already made the content, they've already paid for it. And so this new person is just sort of, you know, it's gravy, it's marginal profit for them. And so the incentives are, in this internet-based world where you can distribute content all over the world, create as big and broad and generic a platform as possible and distribute your content to everyone and use that to justify having this large staff. And I do think that the logical end of what the internet has sort of created with these globally addressable markets are, you got to be really big and consolidate into a Disney, or you got to be really small and address a niche audience and keep a sort of commensurate cost structure that can say like, hey, there's a lot of people who are interested in tech in Seattle and maybe outside Seattle who are interested in Seattle tech because we have Microsoft and Amazon and a vibrant startup ecosystem here. I think your business model, it makes a lot of sense to be a part of that long tail where you say, I got a niche and we're going to serve the crap out of it. And then if there's these people that are sort of caught in the middle that aren't sure if they're big or small, they either got to get small and niche down or figure out how to go join a Disney.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more on that analysis. Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case in media. Well, Ben, I know you've spent a lot of time with us. You probably need to get to the next acquired episode. We've been talking all about deals, IPOs, acquisitions. We didn't even really touch on SPACs, but geez, that's a whole nother show we could probably do. When we do an analysis, right? Now, I'm going to end with this question. Do an analysis. I'll do it on a scale of 1 to 10. 1 meaning the M&A IPO market is going to collapse in the next couple months and we're going to see this bubble burst and things are going to fall apart. And 10, it's going to be like we're going to have new trillion-dollar companies being created overnight. Where do you think we are when you look out 12 months?
I'm like a 7 on that. I think the thing that will, in my opinion, the thing that will precipitate like the M&A market falling apart or something like that is that the multiples people are willing to pay for tech companies are just going to change. And I think that's going to only happen from a policy type decision. So it's like a watch the Fed and see type situation. But the first thing I think that will happen is drops in the stock prices for some of these companies. And then we'll see M&A and everything sort of trickle down from that. So I don't know when it's going to happen. As Warren Buffett says, predicting rain doesn't count. It's building the ark that does. So like, I'm not here to forecast and tell you we're safe until X date. I have no idea, but these things are cycles and something will change here at some point.
Okay. But it seems like roaring 20s for a little bit more, at least in your viewpoint.
Fed set interest rates till 2023. So yep.
Awesome. Well, Ben Gilbert is the co-founder of Pioneer Square Labs and the co-host of the Acquired podcast. Make sure to check that out at acquired.fm. Ben Gilbert, thanks for joining us today.
You got it. And if anyone out there is listening in the startup scene or thinking about getting into the startup scene, come talk to me. Would love to work with you on a new startup.
There's your PSL plug. Yes. Thanks, Ben. Thanks for joining us. And thanks for listening to GeekWire. To see all of GeekWire's coverage of science, tech, business, and more, go to geekwire.com and sign up for our daily email newsletter to receive all of our stories. Don't forget to check out our other GeekWire podcasts, Day 2, about everything Amazon, and the GeekWire Health Tech podcast. And please subscribe, rate, and review the GeekWire podcast wherever you listen. Our podcast producer is Kurt Milton. Our theme music is by Daniel L.K. Caldwell. I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook. Thanks for joining us.